Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this Friday evening, March the 13th on the West Coast, or now March the 14th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I've asked folks to pray for my father, over the past month or so. My father had a massive stroke, and very faithfully I've received a lot of messages from folks who said that they were praying and continuously praying. And I have to tell you, prayer works. My father is showing signs of improving, although he's not able to speak and not functioning like most of us in our waking state. He's actually functioning quite a bit on his own now, and so we're grateful for all the prayers that we've been receiving. Keep them coming. And I can tell you that my father reached his 84th birthday on March the 13th, exactly 1 month from the time that he woke up and showed us that he wouldn't have to be taken off of life support. And so I'm grateful for all of you who have been praying. That said, we're going to go right into tonight's show. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world and outside this world, and we're going to touch upon some of the more basic elements of that with tonight's guest. He is an author. He's also a scientist, inventor, lecturer, and teacher, and he's the weekly guest on Evident Footprints every Friday night now for the duration of this show so far in its history. And he's my good friend and hopefully yours, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Don. And how are you this fine evening?
Well, I'm doing well. Bit tired because of all the all the stuff going on today, but it was a nice day. It was nice to see my dad respond when I wished him a happy birthday. It was, you know, really really uplifting to see that. So
well, I can just imagine, and I hope that he continues to improve.
Yes, thank you. We appreciate that. It's a reminder of how precious life is for all of us, and how important and it is to lead a fulfilling life and a meaningful life. And it certainly causes us to pause and reflect upon how another's life has impacted us. And I think we could all spend time considering how we impact the lives of others, you know, and hopefully we do that in a positive way. Although you can't please everybody, and if that were the case, we wouldn't have email. So, or telephones for that matter. Now, we've been talking about energy and its various forms and its various ways that mankind has begun to use it, and we've been talking about how it exists, how it was created, and we seem to be on this path of we're tired of paying for it, and we're trying to find ways to get it for nothing. And I suppose in a sense, hypothetically, that's possible, but historically, it's not been the case, has it?
Well, I don't know. I think that depends on what you believe and how you look at it. I've always despised the term free energy simply because of the fact that in reality it has no real meaning. I mean, what they're really trying to say is either free work or a gain in work, you know, which are terms which make some kind of rational, that have a rational appeal. But free energy is kind of bogus because in a certain sense, all energy is free. Nobody created any of it. And in another sense, none of it is free, because regardless of where it resides, you have to do something to get it. So that's kind of a strange terminology, which I try to avoid. But the idea of having, as Tesla would say, of coupling man's activities into the wheel works of nature, that was something that he was fond of saying. And that's certainly something doable. I mean, it's actually been done in many different ways. Like, for instance, the most obvious way might be a water wheel or a windmill. And in more recent times, perhaps a direct energy converter using radioisotopes or a nuclear reactor. I mean, there's lots of different ways in which we can utilize the transformation of energy from one form to another to produce useful work. The real key to what everybody's looking for is a mechanism that will do that, you know, without any nasty side effects and without having to do a great deal of work ahead of time to avail yourselves of the benefits associated with that particular class of energy. And those are what make it difficult. But the interesting thing is, you know, if you turn your eyes spaceward, you know, we see that there are huge swirling galaxies everywhere we look. I mean, literally, there are millions of them. And the forces that rotate these galaxies are very, very interesting. And, you know, I'm not sure what Tesla's thoughts were on some of that, because unfortunately, he never published his dynamic theory of gravity, in which he intended to address all of these things. But on other shows, we did talk about the fact that he was very much convinced that power was relativistic, which means to say that if you view its capabilities in one reference frame with respect to its capabilities in another reference frame, that you should see a difference. And that difference can either be greater than what you're supplying or less than what you're supplying. And the mere fact that he was thinking in this direction tells us that he already understood the possibility of power being relativistic and therefore capable of demonstrating a gain. Now, the interesting thing is, if you forget about Tesla's version of relativity and you go back to the Einsteinian concept, it's very difficult to find any kind of meaningful data on relativistic energy, except for the fact that there's the famous expansion, you know, using the binomial theorem. It was done on, I forget the name of the guy's, I guess it's the Lorentz transformation, in which the rest mass of an object indicates an increase in energy as a function of speed. And this is an exponential function which increases drastically as the velocity approaches the speed of light. Now, I'm guessing, because I've been out of it for so long, I can't really say with authority anymore, but I'm guessing that in some of these massive accelerators that they've been playing with in recent years, and especially these colliders, that they have demonstrated to their own satisfaction that, you know, the energy density of a particular particle can continue to rise as the velocity approaches the speed of light. But there's a conundrum involved in this, and that is that the barrier apparently can't be breached because it will take an infinite amount of energy to drive a given particle to the speed of light, at least as far as these calculations would indicate. But I gave up on that one years ago for the simple reason that it seems to me that there's a problem with the logic. And the reason I say that is because a photon has mass, a photon being an individual corpuscle of light. A photon has mass of its own, which is demonstrated by the fact that a beam of light actually bends as it comes around a large star. And that wouldn't happen if it was not affected by the gravitational field of the star. And so it's assumed, therefore, that the light has mass. But if the light has mass and it's traveling at the speed of light, did it take an infinite amount of energy to make it move that way? I mean, I've turned on countless numbers of flashlights in my time, and I never had any problem doing so.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always felt that there's something wrong with that whole mechanism. And on the other hand, if we jump back to the Tesla version of the situation, he talked about the enormous power that's associated with these spiral nebulae and the motions inherent in the mechanisms of the universe. And although he didn't spend a lot of time on this, the only article that I know of that he published in some detail with mathematical support was that famous article called The Rotation of the Moon, which turns out to be a really interesting thing to dip into. But in support of Tesla's theories, years later, Wilhelm Reich talked about the same type of forces. Of course, he used different names than were traditionally embraced by science, and that's probably what got him in trouble. But he talked about the fact that the cosmic orgone streams had a tendency to fold in upon one another and execute spiral motion. And that these effects could therefore be seen in association with every major body throughout the universe, stars, planets, moons, galaxies, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as on our own planet is concerned, he envisioned two such streams, one of them in the plane of the equatorial plane, and the other somewhere north, quite a bit north. I forget what the latitude of it was. But these two things interacted in such a way as to swirl about the planet, and were therefore responsible for the formation of the biosphere and all the life that has therefore come forth from that biosphere, over the many millennia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all these theories are fascinating, and there's certainly something to them in one way or another, because the spiral motion, particularly that associated with the logarithmic spiral, is evident everywhere, and we've talked about that on numerous shows.
Yeah.
The real question is, if there is such a force called the vortex, which is responsible for the formation of stars and planets and galaxies, what is it actually? And that's something that's been racking my brain for many years. The ancients talked about it. You can read about the vortex or vortex engines and the famous Vamana that were flown around in India, 10,000 years ago. and were used against Atlantis in the famous Indo-Atlantean Wars. And a lot of this information has survived in the Mahabharata, where they openly discuss it, but the problem is they don't go into too much detail. It's almost as if they expect you to know what it is. Like it was so commonplace in that time period that everybody was using it.
Mm-hmm.
And but they do associate it with certain things, like circular motion, the presence of mercury, and heat, and levitation. You know, so there's magnetics or gravitational forces implied in that instance. But I've never seen any of this personally, even though, with the exception of one experiment that I did witness years ago with Getz, which seemed to me to demonstrate the legitimacy of this whole vortex concept, and interestingly enough, seemed to be traceable back to Tesla. My theory has always been that it has something to do with the relativistic nature of magnetism, because magnetic flux is very, very unusual in that, depending on the reference frame you're in, it can become something different.
Mm-hmm.
And the odd thing about it is, when it's in motion itself, it's best represented as a motional electric field, which is the very agent that causes generators and motors to operate. And yet, when it's in that mode, it doesn't behave like normal magnetism either. So it would seem to me that we have a situation where flux that's in motion billowing through space may have different properties than the magnetism that we investigate in association with a bar magnet or a solenoid, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps it's when these free-moving lines of flux, which explode out of the sun, actually impinge upon our planet and find a medium that's more penetrable than empty space itself, or has a higher permeability than empty space itself, that as it collapses into that environment, it produces some of the effects that that we've all wondered about, or at least I have wondered about.
Mm-hmm. Your definition and your description of this phenomenon brings to mind the cyclone. In fact, everything in the universe operates in cycles anyway. And a cyclone in the northern hemisphere, if I'm correct, runs counterclockwise or spins counterclockwise, outer winds moving inward. And on in the southern hemisphere, they rotate clockwise. Wouldn't that be related to polarity of the Earth itself?
Well, it could be related to that, or it could be related to the Coriolis acceleration, which has to do with the actual motion and shape of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a whole bunch of possibilities when it comes to that. Actually, they also claim that water goes down the drain in the opposite direction in the southern hemisphere. And the irony of it was, I was there, and I forgot to check that.
Yeah.
I would really like to have a chance to personally witness that.
Yeah. When you describe a vortex, now, we've talked about this on a show, I didn't see the vortex that I felt, and I felt the energy, and it wasn't wind. It was just pure energy that had a substance to it. And my perception was that it was coming out of the Earth, moving outward into space for the listening audience and for you, so you can understand. It wasn't something that was coming down like when we see a vortex in the form of a tornado. the tornado rises from this circular pattern of wind up in the cloud banks, and as it extends downward, it maintains a conical shape, and basically, just for sake of argument, it forms a point that touches the surface of the Earth, and it bounces around or spins around, and it attracts through the, I guess, the effect of the vacuum that's created because of the speed of the wind. It's pulling wind into it, and it's gaining force, and so it's acting like a vacuum and pulling physical objects, houses and roofs and barns and animals and cars and whatever comes in its path, it draws it inward. So there's a tremendous amount of energy, yet the feeling I had of the vortex, a natural energy vortex, was the opposite. That was very gentle, and could have a certain kind of power, but it was a much higher vibration. It was a positive vibration. It wasn't destructive. And it seemed to be emanating out of the Earth upward. It had a spin, and it had a bit of an upward thrust that you could feel to it. I don't know if that, if you've experienced that yourself or had it explained that way, but that might give you some insight as to what is going on.
Well, I have never experienced anything, you know, psychically or on a higher plane, you know, pertaining to the vortex itself. However, I did see one manifestation which was supposedly based on an understanding of vortexia way back in the late 60s, mm-hmm. when I first met up with Warren Getz up in northern Michigan. And that had to do with this vortex motor which he had built and was operating in his basement and set up this huge field that just drew electrons from in every direction. And it was very impressive. I mean, I must say that. The explanations that he gave were not very satisfying, and I was never sure if he was being secretive or if he just didn't know, which always made me wonder, well, then, you know, if he didn't know, where the heck did he get this from, you know? But that's another long-winded story. But the thing that's interesting about the vortexian motion in general is that it operates as an inverse function to that of the wheel. Now, if we have a wheel of large diameter, or let's say a disc of large diameter spinning, you can get a pretty good idea of the forces that are associated with it by dribbling a little stream of water onto the center of the disc. And what will happen will be this will work its way outward in a film until it finally reaches the absolute periphery of the disc, and then it will fire off droplets, you know, in a path that's tangential to the motion of the disc. And most everybody has seen examples of that in their lifetime. There's no point in going into it in great detail. But what's really strange is if you take the equation for a circle and you essentially divide it into one and then plot it, you get a function that does exactly the opposite, and it's really amazing. You'll wind up with the outermost area, unlike the disc, where the center is stationary and the rim has the most speed. If you do an inverse plot of a circular function, you'll wind up with a situation where the outermost areas are essentially stationary or moving very, very slowly. And as you wind in, you'll find that the angular velocity picks up and becomes faster and faster as it reaches the center. And that's where its motion is the greatest. Now, according to what I've read on the subject, the thing that's intriguing about this is that whatever forces are involved in this rotary motion cause a sweeping action through space, which slowly guides tiny particles of dust and matter and what have you into this whirlpool. And eventually they coalesce at the very center. And this is the mechanism that's supposedly responsible for building planets and stars and all sorts of things, depending upon their size and their rate of vigor that they exhibit, and where they're situated in space, I imagine, depends on what they wind up constructing. But it's a subtle force, probably related to gravitational forces, and it's a creative force in the sense that it's building something. But it's also a very persistent force because it must take untold eons to collect enough matter and put it under enough pressure to ignite either a star or, form a planet with a molten core or whatever other things it's capable of doing. Supposedly it also builds atoms, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real interesting phenomenon, and if nothing else, I would love to someday just wrestle with the mathematics associated with it, because it's not just a question of finding appropriate equations for a logarithmic spiral. I mean, people way smarter than me know about that already.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really interesting is to find the dimensionalities necessary to make the equations work, not only in the mathematical sense, but also in the physical sense, so that the outcome would become predictable in terms of parameters that we're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But
now,
anyway,
I was going to make a point here and try to segue back into this topic in the sense of where you were going. In the two vortexes that I experienced were within 100 yards of each other. And yet I had the impression that one was moving straight upward and opening up, fanning outward as it rose. And the other one gave me the impression that it was slightly angled. It wasn't, let's say, perpendicular to the Earth's surface. It was slightly pointing outward at somewhat of a pitch, we'll say, and a steep pitch, but nonetheless not a perpendicular. That was the sensation I had. And standing in that particular vortex, I had the distinct impression that there was something different going on with the time continuum within that vortex, that one was actually responsible for how the landscaping of the whole area ended up being designed, that it seemed to be a vortex that served a different purpose than the other one. The other one was actually felt inside a building, inside a structure. So I had the impression that the structure was built to allow that vertical vortex to be a focal point of energy related to consciousness, and the other one had, it's not that it didn't have anything to do with consciousness, but it was there was a different effect produced when you stood in that vortex. And it wasn't like there was a sign that said, here it is, with arrows pointing. It was just I was drawn to that area and stood in it and experienced that phenomenon that I described, where I saw into a higher dimension. My physical sight was actually taken to the point where I was perceptive in that other dimension while standing in that vortex. So I began to question the nature of each one and if that energy could be harnessed in some fashion, because it was unending. I was standing within a perpetual motion machine. That was the impression I got. Would you like to comment?
Well, that doesn't, Yeah, sure. That doesn't surprise me at all, because if you stop and think about it, Don, in order for a vortex to be large enough to actually create our planet, which according to the old way of thinking is what was going on there, you're talking about something that's in excess of 7,000 miles across, you know, so it's huge. Now, let's assume that after it's done its job, you know, the planet is rotating now within the vortex. And by the way, the planet is supposedly turned by the vortex as well, which is the reason why it hasn't stopped rotating. And that's an interesting point, because everybody always falls back on Newton's laws and says, well, you know, the thing's been in motion for billions of years and there's no reason for it to stop. So naturally, it's just going to continue on turning. But actually, there are enormous losses in the Earth system. I mean, the friction between the atmosphere and the surface of the planet, you know, the currents in the ocean, the movement of the oceans with respect to the Earth, you know, the internal tidal forces inside the supposedly the molten core. I mean, there's just all sorts of things that can rob angular momentum from the planet over the eons, and it probably has slowed down to some extent too, but the vortex itself ages, and so that's not a big surprise. But getting back to your observation, anything that's that large and truly the source of rotating a planet is going to have eddy currents and sub-vortices associated with its functioning. And they're going to pop up wherever it makes sense for them to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I'm imagining is that, you know, what you experienced was like a local, I don't know where you were when this was happening, but I would imagine it was some sort of a local manifestation of the parent vortex or the main vortex. And there's probably lots of those around the planet in different areas.
Mm-hmm.
I remember years ago, Ivan Sanderson did a plot of the major points where he suspected there would be vortexian eddies or secondary vortices on the planet. And he referred to them, as a matter of fact, as the vile vortices. And one of them turns out to be right where what the heck is the name of that triangle? Bermuda Triangle.
Bermuda.
One of them turns out to be right where the Bermuda Triangle is. And then, he plotted it around the entire periphery of the Earth. And they make a sinusoidal distribution of areas. Some are over land, some are over the sea, and there was one at each of the two poles. And he wrote a whole book about this, and I'm just surprised that nobody ever bothered to look into it. But the Bermuda Triangle is only one of 12 areas where strange things happen as a result of these secondary vortexian currents. And, of course, they're still very large. I mean, the Bermuda Triangle is couple thousand miles or more in extent, and it doesn't surprise me that if you get to one of the areas where you have a vortex that's landlocked, and I think there was supposed to be one somewhere in the Sahara, then you're going to find that you're going to have a lot of local disturbances as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, whatever that energy is, it's pretty potent, and it's all pervasive, and I think that it has a great deal to do with a lot of the areas of power that have been felt and recognized by sensitive people down through the years.
Yeah, there was another
included.
Yeah, there was another. I would have to say it was likely a vortex, but I was in a vehicle that was moving up the mountain road up to where this property was. This was in Arizona, by the way. And so as we were about two-thirds of the way up the mountain, and it was just a very gradual climb until we got to a certain area, and you look back and you realize, wow, I'm way up in the foothills, but you almost felt like you were on a flat road the entire drive. But we reached a point where I felt this rush of warm energy, and it wasn't from the heater in the SUV that we were driving in. I was in the passenger seat. It was, I felt this energy go through my whole body, and the person driving the vehicle didn't feel it at all. And it was massive. It was not the same as standing in those vortexes. Those vortexes were much more compact, and probably, I had the feeling that they were focused almost at the surface of the ground, you know, obviously going into the ground somewhat, but a very narrow cone at the point where my feet were standing. But in that vehicle, it was a monstrous wave of energy. And I failed to mention that to you. Even I sort of uttered a whoo, kind of, you know, I sighed and I felt this energy go through me, and I described this to the driver, and he was quite surprised by it, but he said that, you know, he knew it was a very special place too, for lots of reasons. There were a lot of different phenomena going on there. So I thought I would mention that.
Yeah, and it's a good thing it did, because it brings us right into the next leg of this discussion. The Indians were aware of what they called certain sacred places that had unusual medicine or unusual forces associated with them. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they used that word vortex or not, but they were certainly aware of areas of that sort. And if Native American folks can pick up on that, then down through the ages, certainly other people could also be sensitive enough to feel these types of forces. And it's very conceivable, at least to me, that you get a group of these kind of people who are not afraid of it and who are sensitive enough to feel it, and they can basically map it, you know, mm-hmm. just walk around until they find out what the extent of it is and what the shape of it is. And it may very well be that that's the way in which somebody discovered in the lost epochs of time that you could contain a vortex with a particular geometry. And that brings us now to the area where we've been working to get to.
Mm-hmm.
What is the relationship between, you know, these disturbances in space and literal shapes of things? Now, we already know that, we've discussed this on many shows, that the pyramid contains this swirling energy, and it takes on certain forms when it's confined to the pyramidal shape. The other thing that's of interest is that the sphere is related in some way to this vortexian motion, because if you buy the story that the planet is essentially created by the spin of the vortex, then obviously there's a relationship between the resulting spheroid and the geometry of the swirling forces that bring it into creation. So we want to keep that in mind when we discuss the next interesting topic, which is the fact that UFOs apparently are miniature planets which have not only been devised by man, but which make use of that knowledge of how the vortex operates and what can be done with it, and all of the forces associated with that. And interestingly enough, you know, I have heard that explanation so many times from so many different people, both with a scientific bent and from those who have more or less a occult, see the occult side of things, that I really believe that there's something to that, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if the military already knows this. But now, in diverging from the main subject just for a minute, we should consider all of the phenomenon associated with conventional power systems. I mean, these are things that people know pretty well, like steam engines are associated with heat, electrical generators are associated with electrical and magnetic forces, photogalvanic systems are associated with light and heat, and geothermal, of course, is another form of heat. And then you've got various nuclear devices like reactors and things of that sort, which are associated with high energy particles and heat. And those are some of the highlights of things which we are used to seeing in our world and which we have used as power sources, you know, for the last few hundred years. But the subject matter that we've been discussing leads to the possibility of unconventional power sources. And sources of that nature could very well make use of the activity of the vortex itself or secondary forces which are brought into creation when a vortex is confined or humanly generated in some way, shape, or form. And the interesting thing about it is that after having done 42 years or so of independent research in power and some unusual other activities related to this stuff, I'm pretty well convinced that whether they want to admit it openly or not, these rumors that we keep hearing about tapping the zero-point energy and free energy devices and all this other stuff, will one day, if they're proven to be true, be linked back to these more occult or more high-level sources of power, and thereby not only will we be talking about new and more exciting sources of power to benefit mankind, but instinctively we will realize that in bridging the gap between where we are now and where we have to be in order to understand machines of that sort, we will also be accepting the existence of spiritual components that we presently have no idea of the existence of.
Mm-hmm. That,
and I
that's
think that'll have an amazing effect on the psyche of mankind, don't you think, Todd?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I don't usually have this problem. In fact, I never have a problem discussing these issues with you. Yet when I talk to a scientist that I consider to be more mainstream, they're set on these orthodox principles of formulas, and nothing can differ from a formula. Yet no one questioned, you know, that a week ago, instead of a million of these formulas, there were only 998 thousand of them, or, you know, there were fewer of them, and as they devised new formulas on top of it, it was always an issue of, well, you have to accept everything that we've discovered prior to that, even if it didn't make sense, or even if they were only theories. And there's an aspect of metaphysics, I'm agreeing with your last statement, that has to occur. There, just because it's in metaphysics doesn't make it not real. And because someone doesn't understand it doesn't mean it's unworthy of being studied or acknowledged, for that matter. it's always a question of attacking the person bringing out the information rather than, you know, looking objectively at what's there. There may be some phenomenon occurring that cannot be explained by science because science is incapable of explaining it because they haven't theorized what that might be, or because they haven't figured out a calculation doesn't negate it that it exists. So that's all I wanted to say about that. I agree with you.
Well, no, I agree with you there too. I mean, you're right on. I mean, there are so many things that they like to give the impression that they're fully informed about, but in reality, we're just babes in the woods. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't even matter what subject you pick. You know, what's heat? How far can you take that? You know, I mean, ultimately, you're talking about a group of molecules of something that are being agitated. And so we call that local commotion on an atomic level heat. But, you know, how far can you take that? I mean, you can go right down to the, you know, to the very essence of the nature of matter, and then you wind up realizing that we don't know so much about any of that.
Mm-hmm.
You can pick anything you want to pick. It doesn't matter. Light, magnetism, electrostatics, you know.
Sound,
anything.
Yeah.
And you don't have to dig too deeply before you come to the limits of man's knowledge. And just knowing that has always been a source of wonder for me. And I could never understand the attitude, you know, that, well, we know all this. Well, you don't really know much of anything.
Well, if you know all that, then it's not worth knowing if it's not solving the problems that it's created, or the misunderstanding of it. And I'm intentionally using that word the misapplication, let's say. Because science has figured everything out, then why do we have global warming? Or is global warming a ruse? Okay? If science has figured everything out, then why are we paying through the nose for power, the various types of power systems that we have? Why does the price keep going up if they have all the answers? You see, they're not called to task on these things. Like I'm asking these rhetorical questions right now for that very purpose, that those that have all the answers about science have not solved the world's problems one iota. They've only added to them. They've created more problems, actually, than they have solutions. Would you agree with that? Or?
Oh, absolutely. And part of it is actually due to their attitudes. I mean, I don't profess to have anything special over anybody else, but I'll tell you one thing. If you're arrogant to the point of no return, how much new inspiration is going to come your way? How much insight do you think you're going to get to some area of the universe that, you know, that nobody else has bothered to explore? If you really and truly believe, in that way, your very actions lock out the possibility of new stimulus. And Wilhelm Reich used to talk about this, and he said that people's senses can become armored or desensitized, might be a better word, if the individual who possesses them is heavily armored. So in other words, if his life function is suppressed, then all of his senses and therefore his mind is operating at a lower level than what it was designed to do. And in that condition, it's going to be very difficult for you to see some fantastic connection with, you know, the forces of nature that are out there just waiting for you to discover them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of it has to do with open-mindedness, with humility, which very few people have anymore these days, and determination. and having an open heart and an open mind, and be willing to accept without challenging it new information that may be offered to you. Mm-hmm. Now that doesn't mean you shouldn't verify it. I mean, I do that all the time because if I get an inspiration and I just assume that I understand it completely, there may not be anything wrong with what I was given, but there could be something wrong with my interpretation, and that's the reason why I'm always building experiments.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in a sense, you had a guy like Henry Ford running Ford Motor Company when he was called to task in a legal proceeding. He explained his lack of knowledge by pointing out that he hired people and paid people very well to do the things that he couldn't do. But at least he had the foresight to realize that limitation that he had, and he had others do that work. And we're talking about the same type of thing when we're looking at solving the world's problems, particularly how we look at these energy issues, and we're told a whole mixed bag of stories about we're out of this and we're out of that and this is causing pollution. Well, you should be thankful you're out of it then. It'll be the end of the pollution, wouldn't it? I mean, the common sense would follow in that direction. Yet they use this as a reason for marking up the price. There's no forward thinking in terms of solving that problem. It's how do we cope with the problem and still extract as much money as we can in the process. That's been the joke. And so science has fallen victim to that mentality and been misdirected or ordered to hold back on progress strictly for the purpose of extracting or milking as much profits out of what exists before any further funding is gone in or put into research and development to develop newer ideas, new concepts. It's not encouraged. It's inhibited. And you and I have had these discussions off the air where you are tolerant of my lack of scientific terminology and nomenclature or procedures for that matter, but that doesn't prohibit me from conceptualizing a scientific invention because I think about the solution. I'm not necessarily saying that I know what formula is going to bear this out, but if I create something and someone experiences healing in some aspect of their being, or some sort of wellness or happiness from it, does it make it invalid because there's not a scientific formula to explain what has occurred or what is occurring? You get my meaning, and you've been very open-minded about that fact that that's where your creativity comes from. You know, you're honoring the source.
Well, I still like to feel that I'm very open-minded about that, and I have seen things that I certainly don't understand,
mm-hmm.
and that doesn't mean that there was something wrong with what I saw. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
There's lots of examples of that. I mean, I've always felt the burden, and I stress that word burden, associated with being a so-called civilized individual, because we've come to believe, and I would say erroneously so, that our technologies and our cities and the way we have everything all laid out for us and are essentially led along the primrose path from cradle to grave. We've come to find a certain amount of familiarity and comfort in that arrangement, and we have the tendency, you know, to justify all of it by surrendering to the belief that, hey, this is reality. This is everything that we need. And yet, you don't have to go that far. We talked about areas of the world where you're essentially taking a giant step back to the Stone Age. You've got areas in Brazil and in Peru. You've got areas in New Guinea. You've got areas in Borneo where, you know, all of those things that we find such great comfort and familiarity with just plain don't exist. And yet those people, if you will give them the chance to demonstrate it, can oftentimes show you things that the modern man doesn't even recognize. And their reality is totally different from ours. Mm-hmm. Another one that I left out would be which the surviving Aborigines in Australia. I mean, when it comes to being in psychically in tune with their environment, locating water, extracting water and surviving on practically nothing, communicating with animals and with plants and healing people, they don't have medical centers. They don't have all this highfalutin stuff that makes use of all this technology. But what they have is an awareness that there is more to life than meets the eye. And they're willing to work with that. And we've lost that gift.
Well,
the civilized people.
I mean, they're not even, as long as we're not intruding upon their space, they're not even aware of what's going on outside. They're so involved in what, you know, in their existence. And that's kind of what our dilemma is there, too. So many people are only aware of all the extra, the extra sensory, but I don't mean it in a higher sense, extra sensory enticements that they're given. Yeah, the enticements, the lure of technology and the lure of really meaningless show, you know, spectacle, you know. Fourth of July, a quick example. We have a caller online, but I just want to make this point. On the 4th of July, in most places, they like to explode fireworks. Pretty colors, loud bangs, and okay, it's a subconscious acceptance of war. It's symbolic of war, but it's a ritual, and it's we're told it's a celebration of our nation's independence, and yet we're not independent. There's a contradiction even in the celebration, but they've progressed it in the last 10 years to turn it into laser light shows. So it's not even about what the fireworks represent and representing the war. It's about space technology now. They've ramped it up into a new dimension. And they put the youth out of touch with that original event that was symbolic of our nation's freedom. You get my point that they're changing it and didn't. Nobody voiced any dissension when they made the 4th of July celebration a laser light show, you know, with rock music in the background, you know. And it's not to say anything against rock music. It's just, you know, where's that sense of patriotism? It's been transformed into something else that has no meaning. And it's done, and we're just to accept it because the people in control did that. They chose to do that. We don't question why. You know, we don't question these shell games and why with all the advancements we have in science, why are we still living in the Stone Age in terms of our power systems? You know? Maybe you can answer that in the context of our caller. We have Ron. Is this Ron from Pennsylvania? Yes, it is. Ron, welcome to Evident Footprints. How are you this evening?
Good morning. How are you gentlemen doing?
Well, we're doing well, I guess,
okay,
so
I
far.
I have a couple of quick comments, and I had an experience some time ago I'll relay to you and see what your opinion on that might be. But earlier you mentioned about Ivan Sanderson. The title of that book is Invisible Residence. and I have an original copy of it somewhere. What he did in part of what you were speaking on the vortexes was took at least 10 points on the globe that he had investigated as having certain phenomena associated with them. And then he took 5 shish kebab skewers of sorts and made a model of the globe and pierced each one and drove the point through the globe into the, what would have been the opposite as best he had plotted them. Now, those 5 skewers met at the dead exact center of the Earth. It was an interesting thing that he commented on, a lot of other stuff in the book as well. Now, one of the few things I know in life is that there's a lot out there that I don't understand. Having worked with engineers and police in the past and coal miners, I'll bring up the relationship of those three in a moment, very logical people. Now, here we have coal miners in Pennsylvania, which out on the West Coast, I don't think they have much of those out there. Now, these guys are different people. They're very logical, and they're pretty tough guys. And there have been some that have had phenomena occur to them within the mines that caused them to just quit and leave. Apparitions and so forth. You can't tell those guys they didn't experience that. A friend of mine with the New York State Police, a friend of his to this day, is still scared of an experience he had, a UFO out while out on patrol. But cops don't talk to anybody except other cops. But engineers that I've worked with in the past, a few of them have, and they're very logical thinking people as well. Just only a few bring up things, but you have to earn a certain amount of trust with those people because they don't want to appear to lessen themselves or be embarrassed in light of what you think of them. They don't want to appear as a lesser person to you, and I can understand that. You know, most of us probably feel the same way. Well, here several years ago, I was lying in bed, and I was asleep, dead asleep. And I know if I get up and go to the bathroom or if I get up and I'm groggy or hear a noise. Well, for some reason, as you would get up in the morning, you feel a little groggy, a little stiff, and you're stretching, and there's a certain lag of so many seconds, and sometimes people, maybe a few minutes before they're up and doing things. I was laying on my left side, and something caused me to wake up within a few seconds and be clearly awake without any muscular tension at all, and I looked to my right, and floating across the air, no dream, were 2 green, I guess you would call them spheres. Now, to accurately describe them, the color would be as if night vision green. I've looked through night vision goggles. Mm-hmm. You guys have, you know the color.
Yeah, it's a translucent lime green you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
It was almost identical to that color.
Yeah.
And it was almost as bright, too. Well, today you could set the color brightness on some of them. They vary a little bit. They've come a long way with those. If you would have held a right arm, it would be about the size of a nickel at arm's length. One was at about a 35-degree angle off of horizontal laying in bed, and the other's about a 30-degree. The one on the right was a little higher than the one on the left, and they were about 6 inches apart. And if you would look at them, they would have looked at this. They have the top 20 to 30% cut off as if they were a round disc flattened. And they floated from right to left, not diminishing in brightness for about 4 to 5 seconds, and they disappeared. And what I thought immediately after that was, oh, well, what the hell, I'll figure it out another day. I rolled over and went back to sleep and never gave it any more thought. Now, have you known of anybody that had experienced anything like that? And if so, what's your feelings on that?
Is your question for Jim or for me?
Well, both you people.
Jim, you want to respond to that?
Well, you know, Nikola Tesla was often intrigued by a phenomenon which occurred during some of his high-voltage experiments, and he talked about effects like plasma balls and ball lightning and things of that nature. And there was a guy I knew years ago, and his name escapes me at the moment, but he managed to use Tesla technology to recreate some of that stuff, and he was whisked away to a private research facility out in Utah, I believe it was. It was run by the Air Force. And so I guess that there are lots of phenomena involving different types of plasma, some of which occur during thunderstorms, some of which occur, you know, real early in the morning or late at night for reasons that are not clear. Some of them are caused by enormous pressures under the ground involving the compression of piezoelectric materials, which give rise to, you know, sudden surges of voltage that cause some sort of a plasma display.
I've heard I've heard of that phenomenon with the piezoelectric effect being with compressions in the earth in the past, but this particular was no storms that night, although the area I live in, I've had lightning split trees 10 feet away from the house already. Now, it's extremely rare, but that particular night, there was no rain, no phenomena, no anything whatsoever that I could recall. And what was most unusual to me was the fact that I was awakened, and I turned to look in the direction of these things as if I was summoned to respond visually for some reason. And I've never had this happen before, nor have I had it occur again. So I don't know if that link with why did I wake up. I, you know, you can have ball lightning, all kind of things going on. You could still be dead asleep and not know this. And as I stated, the fact that I had awoken and turned and looked as if I was summoned to look in that direction, it was seemed to me I got awake to respond. Something wanted me to look in that direction, and I was not dreaming, was not asleep. I was awake. I know if I'm awake, and I know if I'm not. And then I went back to sleep, and these things appeared for a reason. But what is unusual, why would I have woken up or risen and looked at these things as if there was somebody said, hey, wake up, take a look at this. I just, it just, something commanded me to do so for some reason.
Yeah. How far do you live from the coal mines that you were describing?
Well, the fellow in the coal mine, it was a mine mechanic. I worked in a factory where he did a lot of machining, and a lot of the laid-off miners had found jobs there. One guy, Kenny, was a mine mechanic, and he told me a story of a friend of his. And what happened is he was down in a mine. In fact, they both were. And this particular fellow says, I'm out of here. I quit. Up the ladder he went. And Ken says, what's wrong? So later on, he told him, I guess when he saw him after work, he says, I was down in that mine. I went to the end of a shaft. See, the shafts are long and they're crisscrossed. He went down to the end of the shaft for some reason by himself. He said three miners' apparitions appeared to him and told him these guys were killed in an accident. They said, you leave our burial grounds. And he did. And he never went back into mine since then. And these guys are pretty hard guys. You don't tell them they didn't see anything, because they did. And these guys are as sane and as logical as anybody. And they're not given to alcohol or drinking or anything.
Yeah. But well, what you're describing, Ron, is generally known in metaphysics as an orb. And, you know, many people, I've had Tony Sara Petrinovich on this show a number of times.
You mean my experiences, I describe it to you.
Yeah, we've posted on my website from time to time some of the photos. She has some of those on her website as well, and she refers to them as intelligent beings. Now, there are orbs that appeared during World War II next to some of the fighter pilots, and they called those Foo Fighters.
Right.
And so there are technical orbs that are generated through human or alien technology, and there are actual orbs in the spirit world that are intelligence or are forms of intelligence that are more in the angelic realm or more in the elemental realm. That's one reason why I asked how close in proximity you were to the coal mine itself.
Oh, I wasn't. I was just told this tale by the guy. The guys that were there.
Do you have mines near you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How far are they from your, from your house?
Oh, the particular mine I know those guys worked at might be 30 miles away. but I have mines that I could probably walk to in 15 minutes if I walk fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania, southwestern Pennsylvania, is laced with mines.
Yeah. I mean, your house could be built on an area that's above caves, or, you know, where there is a concentration of the right flora and fauna and inner earth minerals that would manifest or be a place conducive.
Right next to my house, I have a underground stream with a well that goes right across the property here.
Uh-huh.
And the mine maps aren't very always accurate. The law says they're supposed to have very accurate maps, but if you remember those miners that were trapped underground here, nine of them, all here
mm-hmm.
a couple of years ago,
yeah.
There was question about the accuracy of the mine maps at that time, and they're all supposed to be on file by federal law. Well, there's old one- or two-man mines, household mines. We used to call them house mines, where they dig in the side of the hill, put some tracks in, and get coal out. Well, a lot of those caved in have been forgotten about. So the hillside in this whole area is just really interlaced with mines. In fact, there's a mine about two of them a mile and a half from me that had cement portals, and they blew them shut because they had been used for nefarious purposes in the past, and those mines were all petered out, and for safety reasons, they didn't want the kids playing in them, so they just blew them shut, and they,
mm-hmm.
they're real close. This area is very well noted for coal mines. So
well, what you've described to me is kind of like, I'm trying to give you an answer on what might have been happening.
Uh-huh.
You described yourself as not thinking of it as anything, you know, alarming, and you were able to go back to sleep, so you had a pleasant, positive experience there.
Right.
If it was something that you should be concerned about, it would have given you the opposite reaction.
Right.
And you may have been experiencing in your sleep prior to waking up, in other words, an out-of-body experience. And you, on that astral level, you had an awareness of this energy, and that's what caused you to wake up, just to maybe discern more what was going on in respect to your physical body's safety, which is something that happens, because the astral experience, until you learn how to have conscious astral projection,
mm-hmm.
And project consciously and recall what you see and where you go and make decisions on where you go. It's hit or miss. It's a spontaneous thing that is related to the level of your sleep and things that are going on in your life.
Well,
sounds to me like you were just being observed by something of a benevolent nature.
Well, as long as it was benevolent, not malevolent, that's fine. I can't recall the out-of-body experience, but I just recall the awakening. Now, whether
mm-hmm.
I had the experience, of course, I can't remember.
Yeah.
I don't remember having one before or since. I just recall being awakened and observing the two green orbs, as I mentioned to you. I was always
mm-hmm.
curious about that. It wasn't a particularly pleasant experience as far as exuberance, but it was not an unpleasant experience, which is a good thing, of course.
Yeah.
But I always thought there was a reason for a phenomena occurring, and what the reason, we may not know for years, and maybe we'll know 2 days from now. But a lot of things happen out there that I do know. The reasons I don't. I just didn't know if either you or your guest had experience with that and what your opinion might be.
Yeah, of course, I've had a lifetime full of it, but what you're describing could be something explained in a variety of ways, but I feel it's from a positive side. It very likely could have been you were just being checked out by nature spirits, you know. The color green is associated with the heart in the human aura, and those beings presented themselves that way, so just checking you out. They might have stumbled upon you accidentally. You know,
really, I haven't stumbled since then. Maybe they just passed on through and kept moving. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, hey, thanks a lot, guys.
All right, thanks for calling in, Ron.
Thank you.
Interesting experiences we have, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting that somebody would open up and share a thing like that.
I mean, I give the guy a lot of credit for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a shame we don't get more calls. What is that, about the third call we've had in 2 years?
I think we've had a few more than that, but people are, you know, fascinated with the information. That's what they say. So they don't want to disrupt the flow. I'm not saying Ron did, because what he had was applicable to some of the stuff we're talking about. So let's see. Now we're talking about these. I lost track. Actually, we're talking about Reich and his viewpoints on how this energy can affect us. And you mentioned orgone. He also did mention, he called it or short for orgone, or OR, and he had DOR, which he referred to as deadly orgone energy. And that's the energy that he captures within his orgone accumulators to purify the atmosphere the air and even electromagnetic fields that cling to certain energy patterns. And it's actually very dangerous to touch those accumulators when they're in operation, for that reason, because they really work, and it can cause muscle paralysis, for example, if you touch the rods that he uses in those. There's a grounding action that occurs that has a sort of a debilitating effect on one's muscular contractions and relax. Sation, you know, and basically, there have been cases of paralysis or temporary paralysis associated with coming into that direct contact with that energy when it's been accumulated and concentrated. So,
yes, especially in the discharge part of the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
He used to actually use the Cloudbuster, as he called it, which was a series of different lengths of pipe mounted on a hydraulic lift, and they were all grounded with flexible metal hose like BX.
Mm-hmm.
It usually into a rushing stream, and the fact that this stuff not only drew down some incredible amount of this orgone charge, but as you pointed out, if it was improperly handled, it could knock you on your keister.
Mm-hmm.
And it was definitely not a normal type of electric discharge, because that would probably kill you. But the thing that he pointed out was that a charge of orgone, by its very nature, was not destructive to a living organism like electricity is.
Mm-hmm.
And while it may have interrupted the normal internal workings temporarily, usually there was 100% recovery despite the magnitude of the shock. And so here again we find ourselves back, you know, at the same position of puzzlement. You know, what is this stuff? You know, and according to Reich, it was the actual life force itself, which is responsible for all these things. And he basically proved that by using, in his laboratory, he had a setup where he could use this type of orgone energy in such a way that it literally produced the effects of something living from something that was totally inanimate. And, of course, that, you know, the autogenesis experiment was enough to get him hanged right there, because, you know, nobody in the scientific community believes that you can instill life
in something that's inanimate. And yet, he did the experiment many, many times with lots of different ingredients. And from what I understand, it's not so difficult to do that anybody who chooses to take the initiative can repeat the work. The Aranier experiment was published, and it's available on the Internet, and it describes both the positive outcome of this work and the negative outcome of this work in great detail. And basically what it had to do with was taking very, very finely divided material like carbon dust, finely ground sand, or even minute little particles of iron. And he prepared a nutritive broth. I'm not sure what the broth consisted of, but I imagine it's in his notes. And then he would take a pin or something and pick up a small quantity of either this carbon material or the sand or the pulverized iron and heat it to incandescence and then let it cool and then heat it to incandescence and let it cool. He'd go through that cycle several times. And then on the final go-around when it was incandescent, he would plunge that into the nutritive broth, which had been autoclaved so that there was no possibility of the, you know, existing bacteria being in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would let that alone for a few days and then examine it under the microscope. And he found that these little particles that he had heated and cooled and then plunged into this liquid sat there in suspension in the liquid for some time and then slowly developed a halo around them of orgone energy, which for all intents and purposes formed a cellular barrier. And these things became motivated on their own and would move around in the fluid, and he could make them, you know, at will just by a method similar to what I described to you. And he called them bions, which was his basic building block for biological ions, the most fundamental unit of life.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, his theory was that he hadn't created life. He was never trying to say that. What he was trying to say was that life on this planet actually comes from these orgone streams which enter our atmosphere from space and which bring with it this form of energy which then accumulates in the atmosphere. And if you have an understanding of how it works, you can demonstrate that its presence within a microscopic corpuscle of some sort will endow it with properties which look a great deal like life, and perhaps it is life. We don't know. At least I don't know.
Well, if it produces animation, then it could be adapted in some way to produce work, could it not? Some sort of task.
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up because he actually did that experiment also, and he developed with the help of a Geiger counter circuit an amplifying device which literally extracted the pulsations of the orgone from the atmosphere and turned it into surges of electrical current which he then used to run a motor. And, you know, this was done, my gosh, I don't remember what year it was, but I'll bet you it was in the years right after the war.
I was going to say maybe 1953, somewhere around there.
Yeah, or the very early 50s, right. And that was up in Rangeley, Maine, where he had a lot of his stuff going on. And, of course, this brings us now to, you know, a list of unconventional power sources.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to read a few of them off to you because each one of these things you know, is a subject for enormous amount of conversation and debate. We have gravity motors, which operate on the planetary force of gravity. People now are experimenting with permanent magnet motors, which are strictly devices running on permanent magnets and have no electrical excitation. Then the Russians did a lot of work with psychomic energies, which are energies that can be directed by the mind but seem to manifest in shapes and have various effects when they're allowed to manifest. And then, of course, we have one of my favorites, which is the Tesla magnifying transmitter. We have cosmic ray detectors. We have energy resonance and power oscillations, which is some of my work. And then, of course, there's a lot of people out there attempting the idea of tapping the zero-point energy.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all of these different things going on and have been for a number of years. But they all have one thing in common, and that is that they access forces of nature which science prefers not to recognize as being real. And, you know, it's our job, or those forward-thinking people, to say, well, now, wait a minute. You know, some of these people were very, very credible and had really worthwhile explanations for the things that they were able to manifest, and they can't all be crooks and charlatans.
Yeah.
Especially people like Tesla who documented everything.
I suppose every advancement in science has always met some resistance from the mainstream scientific community. Every single, you know, innovation that has come out has met that, unless it's had the government's money behind it.
Well, yeah, I tend to agree with you, and I've often pondered on why that is so. You know, all you have to do is look up at the stars at night or take a couple of drops of pond water and put it on a microscopic slide and look at it on your microscope. And the wonder of it all and the total complexity of the cosmos and the inner world of the microscopic and the atomic should certainly convince almost anybody with half a mind that the universe is, for all intents and purposes, infinite in its manifestations. And mm-hmm. So why should it be such a big deal that other forms of energy and other mechanisms for converting these natural powers into useful work for human purposes, what is the big deal? Why can't they be there?
Yeah,
you know, that's my question.
They have to be able to be metered, number one. Someone has to profit above and beyond everyone else who's using that power source. And then because you have the element of just pure jealousy and envy that someone else didn't think of that idea, that they're paid to do research and that they accomplish. I'm not saying they don't accomplish anything, but it seems like everything that they accomplish is intended to be destructive or to facilitate destruction in some way, you know, to get them there to the point of destruction. You know, the propulsion systems that they use for space vehicles, that the ones that they show the public, you know, the ones that are there for public display, are so primitive to the other technologies that they're secretly using for militaristic purposes or God knows what other purposes, and all the while pretending that there's no further advances. In other words, Tesla's inventions, which occurred before the turn of the 20th century, are as advanced as we've gotten in electricity. Maybe a few bells and whistles with switches and you know, fancy neon glowing buttons and things like that, but have there really been any innovations whatsoever in that area that have benefited all of mankind simultaneously? You know, when the system breaks down in one end, the whole thing shuts down. And it's very primitive the way they go about fixing it. So, Jim, we're really out of time right now. You want to make a closing statement here before we sign off?
Yeah, actually I do, and I appreciate you asking me that. My last couple of closing comments here revolved around just the subject that you brought up. Is mankind ready for decentralized power? And if so, you know, what would be the social ramifications of embracing it if it could be developed? I think that in itself is something that we could talk about for quite some time if we wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly can entertain that next week. I think it's worth talking about because we're confronting now the possibility of certain realities in our food production and in our water supply and a what appears to be a collapsing ecosystem, because as we're destroying the financial system, or while it's being destroyed for us, the intent is to basically herd us into areas outside of nature, move us away from nature, and so nature can further be exploited. And that we could do a whole series of shows on that. So, I'm game for that. If you are,
oh, always. You know, I'm happy to put something together that we can use as a stepping off point to explore those concepts, and mm-hmm. I'll be happy to do that for you.
Okay. Well, I look forward to that. Then, I would like to discuss these things that we've been talking about a little bit further. I think we open up, you know, we get outside the box, and it's very gratifying to be able to do that with you and discuss possibilities of what types of technologies, we can be moving toward and bring into our reality. And we have to do these things fast. It's obvious that those that, want to control things and suppress mankind or suppressing all the knowledge. I think that's an indication of the very people that are doing that, you know, and we have a responsibility of recognizing that that's what's occurring, because it's not a path that I choose to go down, and I'm sure you don't yourself, and many of our listeners don't either. So, I wish you a wonderful weekend, and thank you for being on the show tonight and sharing your scientific knowledge and your great wisdom.
Well, thank you, Don, for having me, and I'll do my best to give you another good show next week.
Okay. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our resident scientist, our good friend Jim Murray. Jim will be back again next Friday. In the meantime, special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Have a great weekend, and in the meantime, have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.